Hello and welcome to Brain Trust Live number 247.
This week on the podcast, say goodbye to breathing air. We're divorcing the Paris Accords to pursue a more meaningful relationship with oil and gas.
And when it comes to the Paris Accords, Michael Bloomberg is now the government, which is concerning in its own way.
Plus, Anthem is the most evil insurance company for yet another year. Congratulations, guys. The hard work at being absolutely awful is paying off.
And California State Senate passes a single-payer bill, and the LA Times is none too happy about it. In related news, the LA Times spent this week wondering why they aren't that relevant.
Plus, London terrorized. The world was Twitterized, and Trump is the same.
And Trump's search for better press kafifi continues.
We'll have all this and more.
This is Brain Trust Live. Hey guys, I'm Brent.
I'm Lila, and you can find us on the web at www.braintrustlive.com.
That's right.
Welcome to our very first ever international Brain Trust Live.
Yeah, man. Not just a bi-coastal one, but a bi-country. We're in bilateral talks right now, you and I.
So true. It's what I've always dreamed we would do one day.
Yeah, exactly.
And we're in bilateral talks just in time to really, like, geek out about Comey's appearance in front of the Senate Intelligence Committee this week, which is on Thursday.
Yeah, it's
we
coming.
Will be bilateral then, too, and we'll be having bilateral talks at that time about it, I assume.
Yeah. I saw CNN on in the reason that I knew that these were happening on Thursday was because I had CNN or I saw CNN in an airport earlier today, and they had like a little bug in the right hand corner that said 3 days till Comey testimony.
They're doing a countdown.
Yeah. Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. So I'm into that.
Trump claims he's not going to try to block it. I'm worried we're going to have like a terrorist attack before then or something, because I feel like he might not want to block it, but like he does want to block it. So it's something,
right.
Something else is going to happen.
In whatever way it needs to be blocked.
Right. And he doesn't want to be blamed for it. So what's right. better to blame than terrorism?
Yes.
So don't let yourself be so distracted by whatever horrendous thing happens this week that you don't remember to tune in for this appearance.
Exactly.
That's our TV advisory for you.
Mm-hmm.
But this week was sort of a slow news week, except that it felt like a huge news week because there were a lot of threats made this week about things that are going to fall apart in the near future.
Yes.
Like Trump committing to pulling out of the Paris Accords.
Right, like the environment.
So like the environment
like our,
might
like
end.
Our world.
The world might end. You might stop having air.
Yeah.
And air is important. And
yeah,
water.
Yeah, we need that, guys.
Air and water are two key things that we're trying to hold on to. On Thursday, Trump announced in the Rose Garden that we were going to formally withdraw from the Paris Accords. But the process is going to take like 3 years, and nobody actually knows what this process looks like because the Paris Accords were only signed in 2015, and this has never happened before.
Yeah.
It's obviously just so he can like cozy up to fossil fuels and like not cozy up to international cooperation.
Well, of course.
It's also started like an interesting war in the family because Ivanka and Jared Kushner wanted him to stay, you know, to commit to the Paris Accords because they are sort of vaguely more interested in the environment than the other goons in his staff.
You know what? I got something to say about that.
Good.
I am tired of hearing reports about those two trying to heroes. Save him from himself. Because you know what? It's not working. And
no.
B, I just don't give a fuck about either of those two. And I think they're both, who the fuck are that? What do I care about what those two are trying to do? They're
nothing, because they're goons who have nothing to do with anything.
Right.
They're literally,
I feel like every time he does something terrible, there's always some story about like how those two were sort of like attempted to like, you know, make him not do something so terrible, which makes me think that that's probably just like something that they're planting as well.
Oh, I think it absolutely is.
Right.
I also, and it's like to, you know, to keep their appeal with young people, whatever appeal they have. My main interest in this story is related to Ivanka's involvement though, because her saying this to him or not saying this to him, whatever this argument was, it resulted in him making a few rhetorical stabs at saying that he was going to renegotiate the Paris Accords.
Yeah.
And the resulting quote is amazing.
Yeah.
Slate said Slate was saying of this quote, the highlight was probably this doozy of a run-on journey through the mind of a madman.
I feel like it definitely was.
I'm just going to read the whole quote. It's long, but I feel like let's live a little, you know?
Yeah.
The quote is, I'm willing to immediately work with Democratic leaders to either negotiate our way back into Paris under the terms that are fair to the United States and its workers, or to negotiate a new deal that protects our country and its taxpayers. So if the obstructionists want to get together with me, let's make them non-obstructionists. We'll all sit down and we'll get back to the deal and we'll make it good and we won't be closing up our factories and we won't be losing our jobs and we'll sit down with the Democrats and all the people that represent either the Paris Accord or something that we can do that's much better than the Paris Accord. And I think that people of our country will be thrilled and I think the people of the world will be thrilled. But until we do that, we're out of the agreement.
Yeah. So, but do you know... do you know who represents the Paris Accord?
I would love to know.
All of Earth.
All of Earth. The whole 192 countries. So
literally everyone. That's who represents the Paris Accord. So if you want to sit down with all of Earth, then
and sure. Negotiate a new deal. Like literally what we did to get this deal was sit down with all of Earth and negotiate a deal. Like this was the deal we got when we sat down with all the people that represent the Paris Accords.
Correct.
And Democrats.
Yes.
Slate rightly pointed out that there are also two specific things that are concerning here. One is that he can't name or even coherently describe the entities that he's supposed to meet with, as we're saying. We're sitting down with all the people that represent anything. And then also, even if this were a real goal, considering that the Trump administration has failed to pass any major legislation in their time in office so far, I don't feel like they're the right people to try to renegotiate with all of Earth a deal that's already been signed. So it's a little bit bombastic of him to insist that he's going to try this. It's cute that he's trying to say that he'll do this. Two European signatories... three European signatories have already said that they're not interested in renegotiating with him. And that's probably for him enough. He probably doesn't need more people. He probably just says he's going to be a tough negotiator and negotiate something. And then everyone's like, nah, we don't want to. And he's like, fine. They wouldn't work with, you know, like he probably doesn't actually want to insist because he doesn't know how to do that. So in any case, it's created a little bit of a civil war within the United States. It's a war between states in the United States is what I think it is.
Yes.
Because there's now a bunch of groups that are trying to gather up people to agree to, you know, continue abiding by the Paris Agreement. And so far there's two kind of front runners. One is Michael Bloomberg, who's been coordinating an effort that he now has a group with 30 mayors, 3 governors, 80 university presidents, 100 businesses, and they want to submit a plan to the UN pledging that they will meet the US's greenhouse gas emissions target under the climate accords, even if Trump withdraws. And then also he is saying you have to pay like a few million dollars that the US has to pay towards the, you know, for the group that, you know, oversees all of this.
Sure.
And he's offering to pay that himself. I, like, listen, great. It's a great goal, Michael Bloomberg.
Yes.
I don't like it when one human being is rich enough to pay a government fee for the most powerful, ostensibly, nation on earth.
Yeah, I mean, like, he's obviously
a major
doing
international
this.
Organization.
Right. I mean, he's obviously doing this out of, you know, to get some sort of personal recognition for it. But he's also doing it out of, I think, at least because he does actually think that it's the right thing to do. But it is, you get into sort of like a little bit of a fuzzy situation when you have, as we said in the rundown, where you have one person sort of, you know, who is a private citizen acting as the government should be acting.
Yeah. I see the other sort of major entity that has formed in this situation is an alliance of states, of the major states of California and New York and Washington,
New York,
I think, to also, you know, abide by the Paris Accords. And that I see as a different thing. And Bloomberg does point out, and I, you know, and I'm sure these states would point out as well, that a lot of the policy that will allow us to meet our greenhouse gas emissions targets are policy that happens at a state and local level. Right. So it's the federal government has to be involved, I guess.
Right.
But,
well, and California is one of those states of the three governors. And we have had environmental policies at the state level that go further than the Paris Accords do. And we've had for years. So
we've had strict emission standards in this state for as long as I can remember, and stricter than a lot of the European nations that are still in the Accords.
Right.
If you will. And I think the strictest in the nation. And again, we're like 13% of the country's economy. We're like a pretty big economy here. So that is relevant, because if you want, you know, if you are a car manufacturer and, you know, people in West Virginia can buy cars that will emit any amount of nonsense greenhouse gas, whatever, not greenhouse gas, but, you know, emissions.
Yeah.
If you have to still sell to the citizens of California, that kind of sets the, if California is a huge market for cars, that sets a standard that affects the rest of the nation. So I think that both of these entities are kind of thinking that it's basically every powerful, you know, economically powerful and governmentally powerful entity that's not the federal government in the United States that has signed on independently to abide by the Paris Accords.
Yeah.
So it's going to be, I think it's going to be an interesting fight. It could be very crippling that this happened, or it could mean nothing. No one's really sure. It's certainly not a good look on us.
No, it's not.
And no one's really sure how there are no non-governmental entities signed on to the Paris Accords. So this would be kind of like an unusual thing. So this Bloomberg group that wants to have their own Paris Accords group would be an anomaly for sure.
Right.
But
my favorite, there's a lot of, you know, we mentioned the three states, which are something like, almost a third of like the U.S. economy. But there's some other large cities in here, too, including Atlanta. And then my favorite, Pittsburgh, because there was that line that Trump gave in that speech where he was like, you know, we're going to be about Pittsburgh and not Paris.
Yes.
And then the Pittsburgh mayor like schooled him hard and was like, first off, nobody in Pittsburgh voted for you, you buffoon.
Right.
Like 80% voted for Hillary Clinton. And on top of that, like, we're not making steel here or whatever it is that they used to do anyway. Like, their economy is booming because they have, like, moved past that and, like, moved to a greener economy and, like, moved to being a tech hub. And, like, they are
right.
not.
Right. That's Pittsburgh
not,
is
Pittsburgh
one
is
of the
not
Rust
struggling
Belt success
because of
stories.
The Paris Climate Accords.
It's like, It's crazy how he manages to put his foot in his mouth so dramatically in these situations.
It would have been a good line if it made a lick of sense.
Yeah, sure. That's always the case with him. It's all bluster.
Yeah.
There's nothing. But
this
also, you know, he says he's doing this for business and for jobs and things. This really isn't that big a win for a lot of a lot of big multinational corporations and large national corporations, because there's going to be a massive amount of backlash. It means that American companies that sell abroad might find that people start to buy products from other international companies because they don't want to, you know, because first of all, if they're going to not meet the emission standards of like France, then people in France can buy Renaults instead of Chevys or, you know, but it also means that there may be just sort of like a nationalistic backlash because people are like, literally, fuck you, America. And so it doesn't seem like it's a win for really anybody except for Donald Trump's Twitter account.
Yeah. And China.
Oh, and China. Yeah. No, China's now setting the agenda, you guys. China's in charge. We're going to.
Yeah, because China is the world's biggest, pollution emitter above us. I think it used to be us, and now it's China. But China has proclaimed that they are still in it, and they are in it hard. And I think that that's because they realize that the future is not in oil. I mean, even countries who are huge oil producing nations like Saudi Arabia are realizing that they have to move on from this. So the fact that we are not leading on this is ridiculous. But like, and the Europeans, apparently, as we found out this week, Der Spiegel the German paper released the minutes from the meeting from the G7 summit that we talked about last week on the podcast, where all of the leaders of those countries were basically like, to Trump directly, were like, if you pull out of this, like, under no uncertain terms, like, China is like where we are looking to now.
Yeah.
And as much as Trump hates China, that just, like, doesn't seem to make any sense to me.
They, like, hilariously, it was almost like they had been schooled by Trump's own staff on how to get in touch with, like, how to make Trump hear something. Because they went out of their way to repeatedly mention this to Trump at the G7, where they kept being like Angela Merkel brought it up to him multiple times. Like, you know, Macron brought it up to him. Like, Justin Trudeau, I believe, brought it up to him. Like, it was like they were conspiring to say the word China as much as possible in order to terrify Trump. And he managed to not listen in any way. And then following the meeting, he was unmoved. Following the meeting, they broke with their tradition where they release a statement where everyone, you know, they release a unified statement at the end of the G7. This time they released a statement where six of the nations of the seven reaffirmed the Paris Climate Agreement just without the U.S. And then after the president made his announcement on Thursday, Macron released a video statement saying, if we do nothing, our children will know a world of migrations, of wars, of shortage, a dangerous word. World, I mean. But obviously, you know, let's be honest, Trump doesn't
care. He also
said,
make our planet great again. I like that guy, and I wasn't expecting this.
I know. I was not. He's at least got a sort of Trudeau-like quality where even though he's, like, basically a little evil, he seems kind of charming because he hits, he steps up at the right moment to say something that's catchy.
Yes. Correct.
I feel like
and he's more handsome than I initially gave him credit for.
That's true. I feel like he got more handsome on purpose. Like, I feel like he had a makeover.
Maybe he did.
He looks
like a
little different.
In love with his power. Now
could
that
be.
He's been actually elected. Who knows?
Could
it's hard
be.
To know.
We don't know. We'll never know. Science, you know?
Yeah.
Meanwhile, we are now looking ahead at, you know, as the AHCA gets battled out, we're kind of looking ahead at what ways the Republicans can cripple the Obamacare markets without passing a healthcare bill, just to kind of like create a fake crisis. And there's one decision that the Obama administration made in particular that kind of handed them a powerful weapon. So that's something that we were looking at this week. The Times had a story on it. And basically, one of the things that the AHCA gets rid of, but that the ACA includes, is an appropriation for cost-sharing payments for people that make, I think it's between 100 and 250% of the poverty rate. So what these are payments that help with co-pays and other out-of-pocket costs for insurance.
Mm-hmm.
And the Obama administration did not find an appropriation for this. They just kind of like put it through as an order and then just kind of like hoped nothing would happen. And there was a court challenge to it, as there was to everything, but they assumed it was kind of a long shot and that if it did come to fruition, Hillary Clinton would be there. And this kind of thing happens a lot of time with big complicated federal legislation where there are like little holes that people, you know, forgot or didn't realize would mean something, and they kind of fill them in over the years as the policy, you know, sort of gets enacted. So, I mean, like, we do this with Medicaid and Medicare all the time. Like, large federal policy programs have changes made all the time so that they abide by federal policy in, you know, whatever era they're in. But obviously, the Obama administration did not predict that we would be looking at a President Trump. And so last year, a judge ruled that the Obama administration had no explicit authority to pay this money to insurance companies to cover the out-of-pocket costs for these lower-income Americans. It was going to cost as much as $130 billion over 10 years. At the same time, she said that the House had standing to sue the administration, which at the time thought we didn't know it would mean what it meant because we thought, you know, there was always a Republican-led House, but we thought we would have a Democratic-led executive branch that would put resources into defending this decision.
Right.
And the thing is, nobody is interested in, though no one's interested in defending the executive branch right now because the executive branch changed. But no one is interested also in dropping the appeal, because if they dropped the appeal and just got rid of this subsidy, it would cut off millions of very poor people's access to healthcare, because these subsidies help them pay the costs that you don't have covered by insurance. So it would be an extremely cruel thing to be blamed with, you know?
Yeah.
Like, it, and because of that, they've kind of left the lawsuit in limbo. So there was an appeal to her decision, and that's what's kept the law enacted. But the Trump administration has basically been like taking it day by day and like trying to use it as a bargaining chip.
Right.
So that they can use it to, you know, to force people to, you know, vote for their own replacement plan, but they don't have one yet. So they don't, it's not like they are in a position to just cancel the subsidy.
Right.
Right.
But, well, and this sort of falls under this, you know, we hear Trump a lot of time when they were having such trouble getting anything passed, you know, his sort of response every time that they failed, which was so many times, they're still failing at it actually, was that,
right.
Every day. What, you know, we'll just let Obamacare, you know, crumble under its own weight, or, you know, whatever. And this is sort of part of that narrative that he has going for him.
They are making decisions to ensure that Obamacare crumbles under its own
weight.
Because the more that they don't make a clear decision about this, the more that the market gets shaky, insurers start abandoning the program, or they raise their premiums because they're afraid that a bunch of federal dollars are about to disappear. And so that's one conversation. There's also another party at the table in this conversation, though, which has been really interesting to watch, which is that insurance companies are playing a really unusually small role in this conversation about the AHCA. And this particular issue is one issue that they're fairly unified on, where they really don't want these payments to go away. They don't want the Republican government to eliminate this money. But the healthcare lobby that like killed Hillary Clinton's health plan in the 90s and, you know, basically got on board enough with Obamacare to get it passed, they have been having a little bit of a hard time figuring out what side they're on in the AHCA Trump Care versus Obamacare battle. And that's been interesting to watch. They were a really powerful lobby in the 90s, if you recall. They were the lobby that basically single-handedly sunk healthcare reform under Clinton. And so in this round, there are some major companies that don't have much at stake in this fight. They're not big participants in the exchanges. They do a lot of like group plans and work plans and whatever. And so for them, it's not really worth making any bold, you know, statements on either end. There are some insurers that are really heavily invested in the Obamacare markets. Blue Cross Blue Shield, their regional plans, for example, they're heavily invested. And because of that, they're really trying to get Congress to fix the ACA instead of starting over with a dumber law. And then there are a few players like Anthem that are supporting the repeal, which is interesting because I thought that they were owned by Blue Shield. I'm like a little confused about how Anthem and Blue Shield are coming down on drastically different sides of this conversation.
Yeah, right? I always thought that as well. Yeah.
In any case.
Yeah, me.
Because of this, because they're so fragmented, they're lobbying. They have like a trade organization, and their lobbying organization has lost a huge amount of influence in Washington. And because of that, it's not really mounting much of a fight against the Republican efforts to push through the AHCA. And so it's left a little bit of a mess. Insurers are not happy with the status quo. They're not happy with how things are right now. They've lost a lot of money on the Obamacare exchanges. The point was that at some point they were going to recoup those costs because the more people that were invested in the system and the more efficient the system got, the cheaper it was going to get. You know, like there were reasons that they were expecting down the road to recoup their investment in this. And that's why they are invested in making these exchanges work and not abandoning them for the most part, the companies that did invest in them.
What I don't get is that I understand all of the reasons why there's this sort of fragmentation here, but what I don't get is that it just seems like, yes, you could not like the status quo, and that makes perfect sense because there are issues with where we're at right now.
Right.
But certainly the status quo, or fixing the status quo, has to be better than getting rid of 24 million people off of healthcare that,
right. are, Those that are people customers are being forced for them
to purchase from these companies over the next 10 years. So I don't understand why they can't get themselves on the same page here.
I think it's because of the way this rollout happened, a lot of these companies did not heavily invest in these insurance in the exchanges, thinking, you know, planning for it to not work out, basically. So there right. are some companies that heavily invested, and they really need these exchanges to work so that they can make the money that they were promised at the end of the road here, where all these people were going to be forced to buy their product for a more affordable price, but also, you know, and for with subsidies, but also, you know, for, you know, many more customers. Then right. there are companies that are not really that heavily invested in the exchanges. Maybe they offer plans in them and maybe they don't, but they largely, you know, work on, you know, with corporate health plans or group health plans in another capacity.
Right.
And those companies would rather there be no rules so that they can offer very expensive plans for, sure. you know, $1 trillion a month for zero amounts of coverage.
right.
And then there are some that kind of fall in the middle as well. So it's partially that there was not a unified, you know, sort of like reaction to the passage of the ACA that I think that this response, but also it depends on who your primary market is, because if you are a regional Blue Cross Blue Shield plan, it's likely that a lot of your customers are low income or elderly right. or other things like that. And so when the government weakens protections for those people, then you suddenly are out a lot of money because the subsidies are what's keeping them in the game.
Right.
If you are largely providing, you know, health plans for Goldman Sachs, then that's not going to be a concern for you. So
sure.
that's, I think, why we're seeing this fragmentation. But there's a more political issue as well, because a lot of companies are saying, you know, a lot of the insurance companies are unified on the front, you know, where they want to continue these subsidy programs. They think that the tax credits in the AHCA are way too low. They're worried about the cut to Medicaid because a lot of them make a huge amount of money on Medicaid.
Yep.
But their lobbying group has had some politics in and of itself. It had a huge shakeup. It had a bunch of important insurance companies leave it. And it also hired a new CEO in 2015 that was going to be this big coup because it was a former Obama health official who had played a really central role in implementing Obamacare. And they thought that that would be a huge asset because they thought that this would be a continuing program. But this has been kind of a sore point because suddenly all of these, you know, all of her relationships with everyone are sort of useless to them because they're dealing with an entirely new political terrain
right.
where like they're like they just made like a big show of supporting Obamacare just as a brand new regime swept in and was like, fuck Obamacare, we're gonna vote 60
right,
times to get
right,
rid of
right,
it
right.
you know
yeah.
So they're having sort of their own issues, which is so interesting because they invested huge sums of money into torpedoing the Clinton health plan in the 90s, which was a similar plan, by the way,
yes.
to this. It was even more favorable to them in certain ways. They went along with Obamacare because the insurance market had really reached a kind of crisis point, or the healthcare system had reached a crisis point, and it was clear there was going to be some reform, and it was better to go along with this than to watch us all switch to a single-payer system.
Yeah.
So now they're kind of like sitting by the sidelines, like fighting a few minor battles, but trying to kind of cozy up to the Republicans as well. And it's made the conversation about insurance in some ways simpler because they're less of a factor, but also in some ways very complicated because
right.
nobody who's on the front lines of actually providing this care is involved in the conversation at all. So it's just a bunch of
right.
crazy Republicans wandering around making vague statements about what is and is not freedom. And then, you know, like a
yeah.
bunch of Democrats having to be like, you sound silly. And that's all that it is so right now.
That's what's happening right now.
That's
yeah.
what's happening. So
yeah.
in any case, that has been an interesting thing to watch. That was something that there were a few articles about it this week. It seems like that's kind of been a little bit of a focus this week because not much has really happened because nobody knows what's going to happen with this healthcare bill because the Senate hasn't released their bill yet and the House's
right.
bill is still as silly as it was. But in the meantime, California passed a single-payer system in their Senate.
Yes.
So
We had
a real exciting week, regardless of all this chaos. Because, so obviously this is just the state Senate. It means it has to pass the state assembly. It has to pass Jerry Brown. He's very skeptical about a single-payer system. So, you know, who knows what's going to happen. However, just the fact that it passed, and it passed 23-14, was one of the more exciting signs that this, all of this insecurity about healthcare and all of these, you know, all of these threats that the federal government is making are having an effect at the state level that has, in certain states, been very positive, which is that getting states talking.
New York State is in the process of dealing with
this. Assembly has passed it, and they're one vote away in the Senate. I mean, you're seeing the biggest and most economically important states in the nation starting to talk about much more radical approaches to healthcare. And that is because, you know, if it's fine if we want to participate in this dumb-ish system that we have, if it's the best that we can do and everyone is doing it. Right. It's another thing if it means that every 4 years our citizens in these states where we do want everyone to have coverage are going to lose healthcare and be thrown into chaos, and we're going to have all these bankruptcies, and we're going to have all these, you know, poor kids in the ER whose parents couldn't afford to get them preventative care, and, you know, all of these things like that.
Right.
We're not really interested in going back to those days in this state, I don't think. I would hope not. California did not have great laws. They didn't have great consumer protections in the insurance market before the passage of the ACA. So I couldn't be more excited to see that there is momentum both in New York and California, which if this plan passes in one of those states, it is going to change everything. It will change. A state like Colorado that couldn't pass it but voted on it last year would suddenly find the votes. A state, you know, a state like Vermont would immediately go back to the system that they had passed to begin with before the ACA got implemented.
Right.
You would, I think, start to see changes made in places like Massachusetts where they have you know, they had a system like Obamacare before, so this is not that new to them, but they could make more, you know, strides than they had made before if New York State was doing it. If everyone around them is doing it, they might as well. I think, like, it would change so much about our approach to healthcare because people in these other states would look at states like California, and they already think we pay too much in taxes and whatever, but they would find out that we're paying $0 a month for our healthcare.
And exactly.
That would be a huge deal. So
it's going to be really, just politically, it's going to be fascinating to see how this shakes out. Because like you said, it still has to pass the assembly. But if it passes the assembly, does Jerry Brown really veto that?
Does he have the leg to stand on?
Wants to do? I mean, I know that he has been highly skeptical and has even said, I think pretty pointedly, that he's like not super into the idea. But like, I just can't fathom
watching the political tide change this way.
Shooting down a bill that lands on his desk that has passed the Senate and the Assembly.
And one thing I will say is if they find a way to pass this in the New York State Senate, Cuomo will sign this because he loves to be a trailblazer. New York State does not have this problem of a sort of curmudgeonly. And listen, I love Jerry Brown in ways. I know that he's more conservative than I am on a lot of stuff. I've always known that. I still love him. But I think he doesn't have as much of a legacy to look out for because that's not really what he's in the game for at the moment.
No, it's not.
He kind of came to stabilize California, and he did.
And he did.
Andrew Cuomo is
trying to run for president right now.
He's trying to run for president. He's trying to pass groundbreaking legislation so that he looks heroic and like a leader. And this would be just like the greatest thing that could ever happen to him. It would, even though he's in bed with corporate America and, you know, like all of those things, I think Cuomo, I believe, would pass this. So I think that the political pressure would be interesting. I'm concerned because the LA Times, when they covered this story, paid way too much lip service to why it's a bad idea.
Yeah.
They were going on and on, quoting people who were saying it was expensive and there was no plan and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, this makes me feel like how, if you are in our bubble in California, you think like, how come we haven't gotten rid of the death penalty here? And then somehow we never get it passed. We have a prop every year about it and it never, we never can get rid of it. Like, I feel like I'm worried that the LA Times is like trying to play both sides against the middle, which makes me worried that the LA Times doesn't realize that they're fucking irrelevant. And this is why.
Yeah. Well, I think you might be right.
Have they ever wondered why they're not the Washington Post or the New York Times? They're in the second biggest city in the country. They're the paper of the second biggest city in the country. And they're like borderline irrelevant.
I know.
And this is probably why. In any case, that was very exciting news.
Yeah.
Less exciting news is that we are in the grips of a secretive administration that's definitely breaking the law and then lying to us about it. So
yes. And they are attempting to block us having any information about the fact that they're lying to us, which I guess is, if you're an administration who is lying, that's maybe what you would do. Yeah, so well, I guess that makes perfect sense, but it's not great.
It makes perfect sense if you're lying.
Right, yes.
You know?
Yeah.
So basically, the Trumps have a new plan, which is they have a new policy that will ignore any information requests from representatives and senators unless they come from a committee or subcommittee chair. Now, this basically blocks Democrats from ever making information requests from the government,
right,
from the federal, the executive branch, because they don't control either chamber.
Right.
So they don't have any Senate committee chairmanships or subcommittee chairmanships.
Right.
And this is part of a broader narrative where the White House has refused to release their White House visitor logs. They've scrubbed agency websites of health and safety data. They've refused to respond to media requests about simple things like whether or not Trump is golfing and shit like that. And all of that has been designed to make it harder for their rivals and Democrats to find out what's going on inside the White House and inside federal agencies. But this is kind of a dramatic step, because this is, I think, you know, what they're arguing is that oversight is a constitutional power that is exercised through committees, and therefore, you know, committees and their chairman are the only people who are required constitutionally to have information to this access to this information.
Yeah.
But it's pretty extreme to say that the rival party, at a moment when it's an overtly political move, cannot get any information from any agency without the approval of a GOP chair.
Yeah, that's ridiculous. And also, there are GOPers who are in the House who are also asking federal agencies to refuse to comply with FOIA requests.
Yeah.
Too, which is like, you can't be doing that.
No, this sort of move to secrecy, I think, more so than like a lot of the crazy nonsense that's going on, is one of the more concerning things, because, listen, we know Trump is incompetent, and we know that there's not a lot of thinking going on right now in certain areas of government.
Right.
And we have said on this podcast repeatedly that we do not believe there's an evil conspiracy. We think they're incompetent, that that's what's going on. But we need to know, because especially given that they're not evil geniuses and they're actually incompetent, having access to information for our representatives, like our representatives represent us even if they're not in the majority party.
Right.
If, you know, they're still representing Americans who have the right to have transparency, you know, in their government. So it in blocking, you know, what is literally a majority of voters, because, as you know, every year a million more people cast votes for Democrats than Republicans. In the House. What is literally blocking a majority of people from having their representatives have adequate oversight.
Access.
And access to information is really unconscionable and terrifying. And classic Trump. Also, that's like a class. That's like a very Putin thing to do, I feel like.
It totally
like
is.
A dictator.
And do you remember
move.
How, do you remember, this is another thing that is sort of just like rich about this whole thing too. Because we remember when Obama got elected in 2008, he talked a lot about how he was going to have like the most transparent administration like in the history of ever. And then that sort of like didn't maybe work out quite as transparent as a lot of people would have hoped. And a lot of Republicans really liked to remind him of that.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's
you know what? There's no such thing as hypocrisy anymore.
Hypocrisy. There's, yeah. They're really not. Yeah. They're not people who understand the irony in any sort of way.
They are not. It is the degree to which like you can literally say exactly the opposite of what you've always said about everything for all of history.
Yes.
As a Republican.
Yeah, we're seeing that.
Wild.
Yeah, we're seeing that in ways I couldn't even possibly imagine.
No.
Well,
it's crazy because it's ways that we're all watching it happen, and we're like, this is definitely happening. We all know it's happening. We're seeing it happen. We're not fools.
Yeah.
We see it happen. And like, we still can't like do anything about it somehow. Like, it's crazy.
Yeah.
In any case, other uplifting news.
Oh boy.
Terrorism. There were
yes.
more attacks in Britain. London had a series of attacks on Saturday where three men drove into a bunch of pedestrians on the London Bridge, which is a big, like, tourist area.
Yep.
And then left their van and started, like, stabbing people at Borough Market, which is nearby. Seven people died. 48 were wounded. The three assailants were shot and killed by the police. I believe one of them has been starring in, like, propaganda films for ISIS or something
for a while.
We just learned that today. ISIS claimed responsibility for the attack.
Yeah.
Although, who knows if they're, you know, who knows how responsible they ever are. I feel like they claim responsibility for any attack that seems like it would be fun to be responsible for if you were a terrorist organization.
Yeah.
But in any case, it's interesting timing because the English election is on Thursday.
Yes.
By the way, the same day as the Comey. The Comey Senate hearings. So it's going to be a wild day on Thursday. Get ready. Yeah.
And also, this brings us to at least my favorite portion of any podcast, which is where we get to remind you of how geniusy we were at a certain point. Because if you'll remember back to the podcast when we informed you that, what's her name? May?
Theresa May. Yes. Theresa May.
Was announcing this, like, you know, election out of nowhere so she could get more seats in parliament, so she could have, you know, more standing to, you know, negotiate Britain's exit from the EU. We were like, that seems like that plan can only go south, and that's where gone. It's only gone south.
Those polls have been closing in,
like, majorly,
and nobody really knows how to poll the UK, it turns out, because the polls have been varying from, like, as much as giving her as much as a 12-point lead and then, like, also a 1-point lead in other polls. Like, it averages to about 7 points, which is much smaller than the 15 points that she had when she declared that they were going to have this snap election.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and that's the – right.
But no one knows who's overestimating who or underestimating who in these elections.
Any of the polling, unless all of that polling – is wrong, which it could be, but even considering if it's anywhere between 12 and 1, that's bad for her because that's half of what it was at a certain point. I mean, there's a real chance that she could lose seats in the parliament.
Yeah, there's a very real chance that she could.
Yeah.
And that would send the exact opposite message of what she had hoped, where she thought she was going to sort of establish a mandate and then somehow is going to end up with even less of a mandate than she had. And it's also, there's been some, like, scandals of the, like, of the death panel variety, but I guess in the opposite direction. Because the Conservative Party released their party platform 2 weeks ago, and they had a proposed change to the way they do healthcare spending, because they're always trying to get rid of the NHS. And their opponents labeled it a dementia tax, because I think it decreases funding. And so now everyone's going around talking about the dementia tax, so that's fascinating. But it's interesting what actually this terrorist attack has done to the conversation as well. So Britain is like a huge surveillance society, and they have had foiled threats for years. Like, the New York Times today has an article that's basically like, it seems like there's a lot of terrorism suddenly happening in the UK, but it's actually just, they've been foiling tons of threats this whole time. It's just like this is sort of like the, you know, the few that just happened to kind of escape their notice. But a lot of critics of Theresa May are highlighting the fact that during her time as Home Secretary, there were huge reductions in the number of police officers. And so apparently, there hasn't been some sudden surge in attempts at terrorism, but there seems to be a sudden surge in no one being able to foil them.
To foil them, right. It's like there's only been a surge in unfoiled plots.
Exactly. The number of plots is the same. The number that have remained unfoiled is lower.
Correct.
That have been foiled. I said that in the most confusing possible way.
Yes.
Was a double negative, and I don't know what I just said.
Yeah,
In any case, that is causing an interesting... The fact that this happened so close to the election is creating an interesting conversation there as well. So that'll be interesting to watch. We don't have as much insight into what the specifics of what you can look at in a British election are because we don't even have any experience having snap elections here. Like, all of this sounds crazy to me.
Yeah.
The fact that she can just declare elections whenever seems nuts.
I know. I want to be able to just declare elections whenever. That sounds fabulous. Right? I would like to have another one tomorrow.
I know. I would be happy to once again wait an hour and a half. I would vote every day if we could do it.
Yeah, of course.
If it could stop Trump's agenda by just causing mass chaos, that would be
fine.
Yeah. Speaking of Trump, he called Theresa May to offer his condolences.
Sure.
For the attacks. And the White House released a statement that basically was just a readout of what he had said to her. It was like, he praised her heroic response, the heroic response of police and first responders. But then he went on a crazy tweet storm and spent the rest of the day tweeting up a bunch of nonsense. He began the tweet storm by labeling the incident a terrorist attack before the police had even declared it a terrorist attack. He retweeted some tweet from Drudge, some article from Drudge, on Saturday afternoon. That called it a terrorist attack, but the British police had not yet labeled it as such. He then criticized the mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, by taking his remarks after the attacks out of context. Khan had been urging people not to be alarmed by the increased police presence because there was going to be a lot of police action going on to prevent terrorism and such. And he tweeted... at least 7 dead and 48 wounded in terror attack, and mayor of London says there is no reason to be alarmed. But Khan was talking about don't be alarmed by the number of police, by not police. Don't be alarmed by the terrorism.
Yes.
He then went on a crazy tweet storm about the immigration order, where he repeatedly calls it a travel ban, even though his lawyers have been claiming it's not a travel ban.
Yes.
And talked about how they need to go back to his original travel ban, not the, quote, watered-down, politically correct version they submitted.
And then started calling out his own Justice Department.
Yes. The Justice Department should ask for an expedited hearing of the watered-down travel ban before the Supreme Court and seek much tougher version.
Right, because he also said the Justice Department should have stayed with the original travel ban.
Yeah.
Like, huh?
Right, oh yeah, not watered-down, politically correct version. This was, like, at 6:30 in the morning, by the way. So he just, like, popped up and started tweeting up a storm about nonsense starting at 6:25 a.m. on Monday and continuing till forever.
Right. But it's it's ridiculous because it almost makes you seem like, does it seem like he actually doesn't want this travel? I can't possibly know what the man is thinking. I don't want to know. I don't want to know what's going on in his brain. But, like, I do think that he is, like, as we've, you know, already mentioned on this podcast and every podcast for years, basically, I do think that he's an actual idiot.
Yeah, I think he's a dumb person.
But I do think that he is smart enough to grasp that his calling it a travel ban is problematic for him in the courts. Like,
I don't think that
not a concept that should be hard for him to grasp, and it seems as though it is, which is sort of shocking.
Yeah. I am not shocked and feel like this is exactly the kind of concept that he's not able to grasp, is someone telling him that his simplistic language that is accidentally appealing to everyone. I don't think it's a media strategy. I don't think he somehow gets something. You know, I think that to him, he wants a travel ban. So he'll just keep saying travel ban because that's the word that's like in his head. And it has nothing to do, like, he is not able to think about consequences beyond that because he's the president. He's the smartest man in the entire world, obviously, because he became the president. And who else but the smartest man in the world becomes the president? So whatever word pops into his head is the right word.
Right.
I don't think that there are any political considerations going on here. And I think that to some degree, what's frustrating is that that is exactly what his supporters are finding refreshing about all of this.
Yeah, totally.
I think that is kind of the schism that has erupted here, where some of us want professional politicians who sound like they have any fucking clue what's going on, even if it's evil. And some of us are sick of hearing politicians talk down to us and are responding to this language, not because he's being so smart to use it, but because he's not talking down to anyone because he is a complete idiot.
Right.
You know?
Yes. Yeah.
But I think that it's working, and it's not that he has a plan to make it work. I think it just is working in a sort of accidental, you know, sort of kismet situation.
Right.
But that this is exactly what his supporters want to hear. They want to hear a word like travel ban, not, you know, executive action on immigration. They want to hear the word extreme vetting because that sounds serious. They want to hear him disparage politically correct things because they're sick of political correctness.
Yeah.
You know, they want to hear him use words like smart and tough and, you know, stuff like that.
Yep.
They want to just hear words that he also wants to say. And none of them are the right words. And all of them are making him sound like he's doing something illegal. And he doesn't care because he's not smart enough to care.
No, you're absolutely right.
He's the smartest man on earth, Brian. He's the president.
Yes, that's right.
You know,
speaking of words that aren't words.
Oh, man. If you are a human being and alive, you have to have heard about the Covfefe incident.
Yes.
Or Covfefe incident.
I'm no in one's... Canada right now, and so I'm choosing to say it Covfefe because yeah, there's more French people up here. So that's not right, but well, who knows what's right.
It's nothing's
no right.
Right
way. It's a fake word. So you can say it however you want.
In the wee hours of Wednesday morning, Trump tweeted, despite the negative press, Covfefe, and then nothing. He didn't finish the sentence. He didn't see that he had written a fake word.
Yeah.
The tweet stayed up for 5 hours. He obviously sent that, went to bed, and then at 6 a.m. woke up again, deleted the tweet, and then tweeted, who can figure out the true meaning of Covfefe? Enjoy. Now, it's obvious that he was attempting to type the word coverage and then somehow fell asleep mid-tweet or whatever he was doing. Like, didn't worry about it. But it was maybe the most fun middle-of-the-night Twitter incident that's ever happened in the world.
Oh, yeah. For sure.
There was a joke on 4chan last fall that Trump, that the United States had elected a meme as president. And that is basically what happened here.
Yeah, we did.
Some of the best Twitter responses include one from Diana7A. Of course, Covfefe is a real word. It was coined during the Bowling Green Massacre. That was my favorite one.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Then there was someone who tweeted, help Merriam-Webster, hashtag Covfefe. And they tweeted back, wakes up, checks Twitter. Ugh. A million lookups for regretting checking Twitter, goes back to bed.
Yes.
Someone else tweeted, in fairness, you get some positive Covfefe from Bri Fife, Fox and Fiefs, and Milo Fife and Fifel as well.
Yes.
And then there was, Covfefe is actually a Rita Ora single, and it's why you've never heard of it.
The
word got added to Urban Dictionary as... with the definition, when you want to say coverage, but your hands are too small to hit all the letters on your keyboard.
So good.
And then my favorite is a mock-up of an old tweet of his from September of 2015 that says, if I become president, I guarantee I will never tweet the word Covfefe and leave it up for a ridiculous amount of time.
So good.
And then someone tweeted, this tweet didn't
really
age well.
There was a funny video that was like somebody did of like a tasty video of making Covfefe.
Oh, yes, I saw that, too. And it's just them, like, splashing things and
yes, exactly,
getting shit everywhere. And then there was also that meme where he holds up the executive order. There were those. There was one from, like, what was it, Arrival or something, where it's, is it, like, Amy Adams who's, like, holding up in a spacesuit, holding up a whiteboard that just says Covfefe on it.
Oh, God.
They were just too good. It was too good. And I don't care that we're being distracted by Trump's Twitter. That's
not
why
that one.
That's why
sometimes
we put it at the end of the podcast.
Sometimes I worry about it, but this was I was happy to go where Covfefe took me.
So true. It was one of the only moments of delight I've experienced in the Trump administration.
I know. Like, yeah.
Just really got to me. In any case, that's the news this week. We will be back on American soil next week to report on...
If anything exciting happens in Canada, I'll let you all know, everyone.
Yeah, thank God.
If I see Justin Trudeau jog past me and then want to take a photo with me, which I think is a thing that I saw the internet said happened last week, I'll be sure to post that photograph.
Yeah, obviously. We're not insane over here. if you need to brag about Justin Trudeau, or if you witness a fist fight between him and Matthew Perry, that's another thing to record.
Oh, yeah.
Just get that.
I got my eyes peeled.
Perfect.
Everybody.
There's not much else to do in Canada, so you'll have plenty of time to look. We will see you guys next week. And until then,
bye.
Enjoy the air that's left.
Right.
Bye.
Bye.